Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Mina Bose and Andy Rudilevich, who are the editors of Executive Policymaking, the Role of the OMB in the Presidency. This was published by Brookings Institution Press in 2020, and it's a really cool investigation of the Office of Management and Budget, which many people don't know all that much about, but Mina and Andy are going to tell us about it. I wanted to welcome them to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project, because I think it originated in a very interesting conference. Hi, Mina. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Lily. Hi, Andy.
Hi, great to be with you.
I guess, Andy, could I start just telling a little bit about the origins of the book? So Lily, you had asked what I teach political science, American politics and presidency studies. I direct the Peter S. Calico Center for the Study of the American Presidency at Hofstra and am executive dean of our Calico School of Government, Public Policy and International Affairs Public Policy Program. This volume, Executive Policymaking, the Role of the OMB in the Presidency, actually the idea for this originated in a conference in one of Hofstra's presidential conferences, the March 2015 conference on the George W. Bush presidency. Hofstra has, since the early 1980s, hosted 3-day conferences on each of the modern presidents. The first one was actually in 1982, a group of political science faculty were having lunch one day the year before and said, the centennial of FDR's birth is coming up. We should recognize this with a scholarly appraisal. And they ended up putting together this wonderful conference with scholars, journalists, public officials who had served during the time that FDR was president. And it was very well received, had very good turnout. So then the next year they did Truman and then Eisenhower. And basically between 1982 and 1993, Hofstra hosted conferences on all of the presidents from FDR through Ronald Reagan. Then after that, as they caught up to the present, it's been a little more spaced out. George H.W. Bush in 97, Bill Clinton in 2005, and George W. Bush in 2015. That was the first conference that I organized. I actually was the George H.W. Bush conference was during my first year at Hofstra. But in 2015, we hosted the Bush 43 presidency conference, and Andy was one of the participants in the conference. Afterward, we published selected papers from the conference, and those were published by Nova Science Publishers, local publisher on Long Island, that very kindly put these together for us in 3 volumes on the Constitution and the presidency, domestic policy and foreign policy. And when that was complete, I was discussing with Andy, who had a chapter in the first volume, and he just really mentioned, it seemed to me by chance, have you considered doing a hosting an event on an institution in the executive branch? And since at that point in that was the end of 2016, it would be some time before we could host a conference on the Obama presidency. I thought, you know, this was interesting. We had discussed these. The Calico Center at that point was fairly new, just under a decade, and we had discussed holding topical conferences, but we'd only done one before on presidential power, which Andy actually also participated in. And then we had done one on, we had started to do these, but they weren't, we hadn't done one on an institution. But I raised it with my dean and in the provost's office, and everyone was very supportive. And so it kind of developed from there.
So this is Andy Rudalevich. I'm a professor of American politics at Bowdoin College up in beautiful Brunswick, Maine. And we, you know, have been involved. I have been involved in researching OMB for quite some time. So I'm glad Mina thought that my raising this was by chance, because it's part of my long-term plot to actually get people to know what OMB does. It's a, you know, often termed sort of the most important office nobody's ever heard of. And certainly within the executive branch, that the first part is true. The second part, internal to the executive branch, is not true. People know very well what OMB does. But certainly in the broader scholarly community, it's often seen as sort of one part of an undifferentiated White House staff. And that is something I hope the volume actually goes some way to correct. Going back to the Hofstra conference, though, that was very important in that Hofstra does have this track record of putting on conferences that are terrific at attracting a range of scholars and participants. And, you know, Mina had so the institutional resources and also the academic chops to be able to pull this off, and did so brilliantly. It was a really terrific conference, I think, in early-ish 2019. Obviously, our timing worked out well, given what was to come in 2020, had we targeted it more towards the actual centennial of the Office of Management and Budget, which is 2021 this year, obviously probably wouldn't have worked given the pandemic. So so we were lucky there. And I won't say lucky, because again, Mina and Hofstra worked very hard to put this together in terms of attracting a good range of people to come. But we were lucky to have Jack Liu, who was the two-time director of OMB, come and give the keynote address. We had a number of people who had worked at OMB, sometime in some cases for a very long period of time. That's something that the agency is noted for throughout its history, and share their expertise. And then we had, of course, scholars, some of whom, you know, like me, are obsessed with OMB, but others, you know, see it as you know, an extension of their research from different directions. And so, you know, that combination, I think, worked quite well in the volume.
Yeah, I mean, in reading the book, it was really useful to have various voices and different voices sort of coming into the conversation, not only about the institution itself and it and the way that it works, but also, as you note, like, who perceives it in different ways, because people who work in the executive branch have a particular relationship with OMB, whereas most citizens are like, it's some government agency something, and not quite sure what its job is. So in an effort to clarify what its job is for those who aren't as familiar as presidency scholars can be, the role of the subtitle of the book, The Role of OMB in the Presidency, is really the sort of lassoing of the way that this agency works with the presidency, but it also works with the executive branch. And as Andy, you noted, it's almost 100, it's 100 years old this year. But it used to kind of be something else, right?
It did. So back in 1921, it was created as the Bureau of the Budget, and it was actually created as part of the Treasury Department at the time, really conceived of as a tool to help the president produce a unified executive budget. And, you know, this is something we take for granted today, that the president will produce a budget every year. What Congress does with it, of course, remains legislative business. But, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, there was a lot of concern that, you know, all these management techniques that were coming in were being sort of ignored by the federal government, that there was a what one scholar called a budget result rather than an actual budget proposal, that, you know, ultimately Congress would pass all these bills and they would add up to something, right? And you might have a deficit or you might not. And after World War I, especially when you had you know, very high deficit spending, which was not common at that point in the United States, certainly not to the extent we've gotten used to it today, there was concern, right, that we weren't running the government very effectively. And so that combined with sort of this progressive era notion of what management should look like, which tended to involve more executive involvement, led to the creation of this organization, which really saw itself at the outset, not really as the president's tool so much as a tool for efficiency in government. It was designed to keep spending down. And the first director, a guy named Charles Dawes, who would go on to be vice president, actually, Dawes announced that his job was to carry out whatever the government wanted to do in the most efficient way. So if, for example, Congress wanted to pile trash high on the White House steps, it would be his agency's job to figure out how to distribute that trash most efficiently.
And Mina, would you like to add anything to that?
No, I think we can certainly get into kind of the evolution of BOB, OMB, and its role in executive policymaking. What I think one of the parts of this volume, the symposium, which then we were fortunate to be able to develop this into an edited volume, and one of the reasons why I think that was possible is because the volume really takes a comprehensive look at OMB from the evolution, and you see that in the introductory chapters, the what Andy kind of referred to earlier, or the most public side of OMB, its role in the budgetary process. That's probably what students, expert followers, right, people who follow politics would be aware of, but a lot of people are not aware of the role of OIRA, Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, the OMB's role with overseeing executive orders. Obviously, that's Andy's area of expertise, as in all things OMB. And then one of the parts that I thought was most important, was most interesting, was the last section of the volume, which looks at internal management and how this agency works within the executive branch and seeks to achieve, right, the term neutral competence that's been used within its own agency, within its own staff.
And that was one of the points that I found really interesting in reading this book. And Andy wanted to add a couple of things to this part of the conversation. Go for it.
Yeah. So just to note, there are several key sort of evolution points, in this institution over the 100 years, right? One comes relatively fast, and this is FDR sort of seizing hold of the Bureau of the Budget. He moves it into the Executive Office of the President, takes it out of the Treasury Department, and begins to use it as a management arm of the presidency in a way that we can certainly circle back to. But the idea that it would be machinery on behalf of the president, not just in this sort of budgetary function, but in the management functions that Mina alluded to, is very important. In 1970, maybe, is the next big step, right? Which is when Richard Nixon decides he wants to add the name management explicitly to the institution's title, right? So it moves from the Bureau of the Budget to the Office of Management and Budget. And there is a layering of political appointees that takes place at that time. But even then, one thing that's worth stressing is that OMB, this idea of neutral competence, comes from the idea that these are largely civil servants, right? This is an organization of about 500 staff. That size has changed remarkably little over time, even though arguably it should be bigger than it is, given the responsibilities it has. But most of them are civil servants, right? Careerists. And so while there are certainly political appointees, and that number has risen over time, it remains an organization that can provide institutional memory to the president. So there have been, you have the B side and the M side of OMB, those sort of ebb and flow in different ways. But, generally, the organization has remained similar over sort of certainly its post 1970, 50 years. And that said, of course, the broader political context in which it operates has changed. And that has meant some shift in the way it operates. And, you know, it has been an interesting feature. A number of the authors talk about its role, for example, in the Trump administration. We can't speak in the volume to Biden's administration, though we can certainly talk about that today. But those sort of the expansion of the agency as part of the president's managerial toolkit, which includes the budget. And actually, one of the chapters does a very nice job of talking about the budget as management. That's Eloise Pashkov's chapter. But the general outline of the agency, you know, those two big shifts, I think, make it more or less what it is still today.
And in terms of that shift, and again, you both and your authors sort of pay attention to this, as you just noted, Andy, there's a move during the Nixon administration to add that management into, so it's not just the Office of Budget, but there's also a comparable move that Congress does at this point that also becomes part of the sort of DNA, shall we say, of what OMB is doing in terms of budget construction. Can you talk a bit about how that also shifted some of the way that OMB operates and what Congress also created for itself to kind of mirror, try to mirror what OMB does?
Sure, yeah. So in 1974, Congress is peeved with Richard Nixon in all kinds of ways. And we could talk about all of those ways, but the way that important here is the so-called battle of the budget. And this is a longstanding argument between presidents and Congress, but Nixon, as was his wont, pushes it that one step further and begins to stop spending money that the Democratic Congress had appropriated. And this was called impoundment, right? So the president refused to spend money that had been appropriated. By the way, not to get ahead of ourselves, but this is also at issue in the first Trump impeachment. But back in the 70s, it's a pretty big deal. Nixon is effectively using, or at least his accusers say, he's using impoundment as a way of imposing a line item veto, right? So Congress will pass stuff he doesn't like in an appropriations bill. Nixon will sign the bill into law, but then he won't spend the money. So he's not enforcing the law that Congress has demanded, required that he enforce. And this came to a head over some water treatment projects, basically. That's what the lawsuit was. And ultimately, this goes to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court says that the president cannot refuse to spend money that Congress has appropriated. But even before that, Congress had responded politically by passing the Congressional Budget Act and Impoundment Control Acts of 1974. And so the latter, impoundment control, is what it sounds like, stopping the president from being able to withhold the issuance of funds that Congress has approved. Congressional Budget Act, though, is a way of Congress trying to deal itself back into the budgetary game. Having given the president this organization that can create a unified budget, Congress wants to be able to centralize its own consideration of the budget. And this hasn't worked out entirely as planned, but one of the stops along the way is the creation of a Congressional Budget Office. And its job is effectively to be the legislature's OMB. They have grown to distrust OMB, despite all those nice rhetoric back in the 1920s. And, you know, we're going to work for Congress, too. Congress has come over time not to buy that. It really has become a presidential outfit. And so they want their own independent analysis. They want the ability to know what they're spending, a shift in the income tax rate will mean for revenues, what a shift in an assumption about Social Security spending will mean for expenditures. We have the rise of entitlement spending by this time, so it's getting complicated. And so the ability to have a nonpartisan, that's very explicitly nonpartisan, CBO is different from OMB in some ways. So CBO, you know, is created effectively to counteract OMB, but also it's a different kind of institution, but one that provides another set of estimates about what a bill will cost, what a policy shift will charge. And so when we talk about scoring policy proposals, that's a term that's thrown around by budget analyses That's what they're talking about. You know, how is a particular proposal scored in terms of its impact on the budget? And that became really important in the 80s and 90s when people actually cared about the deficit. It's kind of come down now.
I guess just add one point, just on the importance of that evolution of the budgetary process, both in the executive branch and on Capitol Hill. And what was very important for us in organizing this symposium and the volume was to make sure that those multiple perspectives were represented. And so in the volume, we have a chapter on the view from Capitol Hill of budgetary politics, the evolution of OMB. We have a chapter from a professor who served as a PAD in the Obama administration, in the White House, and then over to OMB. So you have executive, institutional, legislative perspectives represented in the volume, and then combined, complemented with also other work that look at survey research and original data sets that were used, and then practitioner perspectives as the discussants who provided just invaluable commentary. So it was important to us to have a comprehensive assessment of how the executive policy making process takes place with OMB. And so, and then, and to incorporate the legislative perspective on that as well.
And in talking about OMB, as we're throwing all of these acronyms around, and, you know, as oftentimes those of us who study the American government, particularly executive branch, it's alphabet soup, as we know. Nina, what is a PAD?
I knew that was going to happen. Presidential Associate Director. Did I get that right, Andy?
Policy Associate Director, I think.
I was actually going to try to look that up. I knew as I said it that was going to come up, and I should have. This was a terrible thing to not be. Program Associate Director, yeah.
Program Associate Director, there we go.
Yeah. Thank you, Lily.
Worth noting maybe that the... they are the kind of lowest ranking political appointees in OMB. So the director and the deputy director, and then there's actually a second deputy director for management. And then you have these statutory offices that are created like OIRA, which another acronym, though Mina did say what that was earlier, but they are the regulatory czars of the executive branch. But PADs were created in that 1970 reorganization, well, a little bit later, but they were basically created in the Nixon administration to provide a little more political control over the programs of government. So they deal with policy, and there's one basically for each of the categories of policy. So they're, OMB is divided up into resource management offices, RMOs, to spin off yet another acronym. And, you know, there's one for health, and there's one for defense, and there's five or six, depending on the administration. And there's usually one PAD for each of those. And they oversee almost all careerists underneath them.
So how many political appointees are there within the OMB structure? Because you said, Andrew, that it had been few, it's increased a little bit, but it's still not a substantial number, that the most of the people, the vast majority of the people who work in OMB are civil servants.
Yeah, so this number is a little hard to pin down, administration to administration. There are only really, well, so there are three Senate-confirmed positions, the director and two deputy directors on sort of the top of the hierarchy. And then, as I say, those statutory offices like OIRA each have a confirmed director. Except for OIRA, they usually attract very little attention. And so then there are political appointees like PADs who are presidential appointed, but not Senate confirmed. And depending on, you know, who their assistants are, I don't know how deep in the weeds you want to get of the Schedule C's of the world and all the different civil service exemptions to the civil service. But, you know, usually there's somebody called the executive associate director, who's sort of the right hand person to the director, doing a lot of the internal bureau management. And, you know, so there may be people who are not careerists, but who have moved in possibly from other parts of government or from external sources. And so, you know, those numbers, again, will vary. But many of them are not particularly partisan, right? You've got the director's suite, effectively. Those people normally are brought in administration by administration. The pads certainly shift administration to administration. But some of the people, even in, you know, who might technically be non-careerists are, you know, are in government for the long haul. So somebody like Martha Coven, who was alluded to earlier, right, had been working in the White House on one of the policy councils, domestic policy council in her case, and then moved over to OMB as a PAD. And then, you know, sort of made a recent return as the chair of the Biden administration's transition team for OMB.
And
so,
and in terms of like something that isn't in the book, but has recently happened, is this was the only appointee so far that Biden withdrew, was his appointee to be the director of OMB. And so how do we think about that, given the research that you all have pulled together in this book in terms of understanding that directorship and how it has become extremely political?
You know, I think that one, it's an interesting question and one that I've kind of been thinking about a lot since the Neera Tanden's nomination, and then the withdrawal of that nomination, and the position, to my knowledge, is still not filled. It's still in acting, right? There hasn't been a Senate confirmation, nomination or confirmation yet. And I think the volume, we did not do a chapter specifically on the OMB director, but I would say the role of the director underlies each of the chapters. And of course, we were fortunate to have a former OMB director and former Treasury Secretary and former White House Chief of Staff, Jack Lew, participate in the event and in our symposium, and wrote a preface and really had a chance to engage with all of us on the first day of our symposium. And I think what I would say, you see there the importance of the agency and of, I guess, how, for me at least, as someone who hadn't studied OMB previously, how institutionally rich OMB is. And we were fortunate to have dads, deputy associate directors, right, as discussants for the our panels. And to hear their career expertise and how much they guided the budget process over decades, and the deep respect and recognition that Secretary Lew gave to them in the symposium, in the preface, throughout just the kind of the interactions and the conversations about different budget times, right? Different case studies. There's some examples in the book, but I think you see, I guess I would say, Lily, how the OMB director position at least should be, and I probably apply this to other cabinet agencies, more institutional than political. And as political scientists, I don't want to kind of oversimplify here because we know that politics is involved in any Senate confirmed appointment, but that there really is so much institutional depth in the agency. I think Jack Lew said in the symposium, the agency punches above its weight, right? That they do so much, right? Making do with less. And just a quotation from another project. But I think we really see that. So I guess this is kind of a long response to your question about the OMB directorship. It is unfortunate, I think, to see the lack of this position in place. Particularly, it's the only cab, the Senate confirmed position in the kind of top cabinet that hasn't been that is open right now in the Biden administration. But I think you also see the depth within the agency that makes it, you know, one of the reasons why in our volume we focus on the OMB director in connection with policymaking, management, the evolution of the agency, rather than a separate chapter on the individual alone.
Yeah, just to note that, you know, the confirmation of even the OMB director dates only from the 1970s as well. This was something that Congress sort of did to get revenge, if you will, on Nixon in yet another way. And there had been a lot of resistance over time to this agency being seen as, well, an agency rather than as part of the presidency, right? And it occupies this weird legal netherworld where it actually is an agency under federal statute, which, by the way, for scholars means that you can find its records in the National Archives and not in the presidential libraries, which is mostly a good thing because there's more available to you sooner through that mechanism. But, you know, it is one of these, it's in this kind of odd place where, you know, you can FOIA OMB. You can, you know, get records from OMB. And so it's seen sometimes as being, you know, a little outside the orbit of the White House. This is a continuing tension that shows up in a lot of the chapters in the volume, is this sort of tug between responsiveness and pure competence. You know, how responsive should it be? And Neera Tanden clearly got caught up in that in her nomination process, right? This idea that she was a partisan, she had said mean things about senators. You know, and the OMB director really does have to straddle, you know, this ability to manage an important agency and to be very good substantively and to, you know, serve the president along with the presidency. And that's hard to do. Again, in the old days, that wouldn't have been an issue. You know, if Joe Biden wanted to appoint Neera Tanden, he would have just done it. Now, of course, you do have to go through the confirmation process. It is the first time that a president's initial pick for OMB director has not been confirmed. Again, that's not a really lengthy timeline, only going back to the 70s, starting with Gerald Ford's pick, I believe. But it's notable. And of course, now you have the deputy director, who had been a longtime congressional budget person on the staff there, serving as the acting director. So I don't think there's any real loss in competence. She certainly knows the process well and has worked with OMB from the Hill side of the equation. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, whether the responsiveness side is seen as somewhat lacking with, you know, she's a Biden person now, but not in the way that maybe a confirmed director would be. So it's it remains intriguing. And it's also, by the way, goes against one of the recommendations in the volume. The some of the good government folks from D.C. Were good enough to write a conclusion chapter. And they said, yeah, you need to work on this fast, get people in place, make sure there's a confirmed director early. And even before her confirmation process kind of derailed, it wasn't an early pick. There was it doesn't appear to have been the priority that, you know, when I'm president, I will make it.
And can I just pick up on that? One thing, I'm glad you brought up the Partnership for Public Service report, Andy, because they, Partnership for Public Service had prepared a transition report in 2016. And they were kind enough to update that for the volume and really kind of planning for writing that, because the volume came out before the election, the 2020 election, to discuss both the needs of either a second term or a new administration. And indeed, that this was one of the topics that they bring up.
And I had noticed, because you do have the listings of all of the OMB directors in the back of the book, and I was flipping through that right before we got on. And, you know, I did remember that Mick Mulvaney had two jobs for a period of time, both of them interim, but that the Trump administration had mostly had interim OMB directors. I mean, I understand that Trump administration had a lot of interims at Justice and other places as well, but that his OMB directors didn't go through the Senate confirmation process during most of his administration.
Well, Mulvaney did, and he was, as you say, it's sort of a world apart talking about Trump administration appointments, but Mulvaney was nominated, right, and confirmed as OMB director, then served over at the, I'm going to get my acronym wrong here, CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, when, you know, President Trump was trying to find a loyal appointee who could kind of trim their sails. But then, of course, as you know, moved over to the White House as acting chief of staff, never was not the acting chief of staff, I don't think, and retained technically his position as budget director that whole time. And then left both, and Russ Vought, who had been the deputy director, who was kind of delayed in getting confirmed in the first place, but then, you know, I think effectively ran the agency while Mulvaney was off doing other jobs. He was not confirmed until 2020 as actual director, and so served in that role as confirmed director for, as you say, a pretty brief time.
And it sounds in that model, it sounds also like what FDR did in bringing the Bureau of the Budget into the sort of executive office of the president, as opposed to sort of having it out there sort of separately in Treasury. That by sort of pulling Mulvaney in, Trump was doing a sort of similar kind of move, or at least trying to.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because presidents have often relied, I mean, this is a recent trend for OMB directors to become White House chiefs of staff. You know, going back to the Clinton administration, you have Leon Panetta, right, who was, again, a longtime member of Congress, then becomes Clinton's OMB director, and then White House chief of staff, Jack Lew, who we've already mentioned, does the same for Obama. Mulvaney does the same for Trump. Again, the other two did leave their OMB position more formally. I don't get the sense that Mulvaney had much of a footprint in OMB after he became White House chief of staff. But, you know, again, that's for future research to dig into a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, one of the things the OMB director has going for them, right, is that they know the whole government. And so, you know, if they can be good at running OMB, they should have a good handle on, you know, the different processes that are working, you know, broadly speaking, the president's program, whether that's legislative, budgetary, regulatory, you know, through executive orders, you know, the whole government view is something that OMB takes very seriously. So if you are a good director, then you actually are in a pretty good position to come over to the White House, right? And to sort of replicate that with fewer, you know, management in a small sense, right? Organizational management responsibilities. You know, and I think on the whole, certainly Panetta and Lew are seen as decent White House chiefs of staff. Mulvaney, I don't know, I guess the jury would still be out there. Better than the guy who succeeded him, I will say that much.
I guess I would, just the one thing I would add was that I would hesitate to make comparisons between Trump's centralization of decision-making and previous modern presidents. I think there was very little, I would say, kind of broader institutional perspective or balancing of politics and institutionalization. What I would say, we were actually, the timing, it's a small point, but Russ Vought was the acting director for almost a year. And it was right around the time that the pandemic started that Trump announced that he would be formally nominated. And if I'm correct, Andy, we were able to just squeeze in that confirmation. I mean, the book was literally, we had reviewed second page proofs. I think the confirmation went through, if I remember, in July of 2020, and we were glad to have the historical record accurate in the volume up till the time of publication. But again,
He was confirmed in July 2020. Yeah, I think you're right. We got it into a footnote.
We got it. It's at the end of the chart, right before publication. But I think, Lily, that's interesting because it's illustrative of just how closely held that decision making was and how unpredictable it was in the Trump administration.
Right. By the way, just to be complete, we should note that Josh Bolton in the Bush administration was also both OMB director and White House chief of staff.
So it is a path.
It is.
As we used to say, as you all know, you know, the early presidents were secretaries of state. And I always tell my student that was the path to getting to be president. So this is, you know, your path to White House chief of staff is OMB director.
So we haven't seen any of them run, correct? We haven't seen any of them.
The other way.
None of them. considered a presidential run, to my knowledge.
Well, Charles Dawes, as I said, was vice president. I think that's the highest they've gotten. I don't know. It's interesting. There have been members of Congress, you know, and others who have, you know, and people who become governor. McDaniels, for example, a Bush administration OMB director, became governor of Indiana. He's president of Purdue, right?
Right. Correct.
Yeah. A presidential, actually, of the recent OMB directors, probably the one who I think was kind of considered the most like a very likely contender in 2012, I guess.
So I wanted to bring you back a little bit to the structure of the book itself, because we've talked a little bit about the OMB and the budget process and the sort of history. But we have a whole second section that uses the term central clearance. And Andy, of course, has a chapter on this because he has a particular interest, I believe, in executive orders. But this is something that OMB does. And it's a really important point in terms of its process and its function in this, you know, sort of nebulous world that it sort of exists in. So if you could explain a little bit about what central clearance is and how it works within the OMB process and ways that it is and isn't political.
Andy, that's your chapter, so I'll turn it over.
All right. Well, I love central clearance, so you feel free to cut me off at some point. So this goes back to Franklin Roosevelt and his notion that then the Bureau of the Budget could be a useful piece of machinery for executive management. Because, you know, you're coming in as president, you don't really know what's happening in the different departments and agencies. And at that time, you didn't have a significant staff that could help you find out what's going on. So, you know, FDR had a bureaucracy he broadly trusted. After all, he built a lot of it himself. And so in that sense, he's quite different than Trump, in that Trump, you know, distrusted the whole idea of the deep state, right? So there's, I think, a different relationship. But even so, Roosevelt wants to know what is going on in government, and he wants it to bear his imprint, right? Not everything that government does is something that the president wants it to do. And Roosevelt wanted to effectively protect himself against, you know, the deep state circa 1935. And so he has different coordinating mechanisms that he experiments with, ultimately basically settles on the Bureau of the Budget, as I say, moves it into the executive office of the president, which is brand new itself at that time in 1939, and uses it to coordinate a legislative program, as well as executive orders. And on the legislative side, that means effectively, this really comes into its own in the Truman administration, canvassing the entire executive branch to find out what it wants to do legislatively, and then kind of forming some of that, the best stuff, into a presidential program. But really anything that an agency wanted to submit to Congress, anything that it wanted to say to Congress in testimony, any kind of position it wanted to take on legislation as it moved through the legislative process. You know, OMB, I'm just going to call it OMB to avoid confusion, was in charge of, you know, clearing that and making sure both that the president knew what was going on, but also that other agencies knew what was going on. And so one reason that agencies actually don't mind this kind of peer review process is that they get the chance to weigh in. And so if you're the agriculture department, you don't want the interior department, you know, stealing a march on you, proposing something to Congress that will give the interior department control over something that you in agriculture really want. And that's not a random example, by the way. They're always arguing with each other. The archives are fun in that way. The general idea, though, is that the president will know what's happening, and he can say, yes, this, I want to be part of the presidential program. This, yeah, feel free to submit it, but it's not mine. Or this other stuff, no, don't even do that. In fact, we now know, you know, from having surveyed all the other interested parts of the executive branch, we know that this is a terrible proposal and we're not going to go forward with it. And so there's that sort of, it's informational both for the agencies and notably for the president, a way of basically getting around the information asymmetry that presidents have. They don't know as much about what's going on in this huge executive branch as they would like to. OMB provided a means of doing that. So the legislative side is one important piece of that, especially when presidents' main programmatic efforts were on the legislative side. Executive orders become part of that quite early. And so one thing people may not realize is that many, even most executive orders don't come from the White House originally. They come from the departments and agencies. They're sort of proposed by a department. Mr. President, please issue an executive order doing X. And that too goes through this clearance process where OMB receives the draft executive order, and then it will send it out to all the different agencies that it thinks might be interested, and then decide what to tell the president. Will it recommend that the president sign and issue this executive order? Maybe not. Maybe it needs to be revised. And so it's a way, again, of, you know, agencies are very good at saying, Mr. President, you've got to do this. This should be a great thing. But, you know, the president can be easily sold a pig in a poke in this sense, right? There are, you know, the counterexamples are always the fun ones, the ones where Dick Cheney goes to the president, gets him to sign something that has received not even an eyeball from the Secretary of State, for example. But there are examples of that kind of end run through history, and presidents who have resisted the end run have generally gotten better substantive results. And that, you know, is one reason for the creation of the institution itself. So just the last thing I'll say is that regulatory review was added later in the 1970s and especially in the 80s to the current day. This is Rachel Potter's chapter in the volume. Rachel has written a whole book about OIRA, again, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is created in 1980 at the very tail end of the Carter administration. And then effectively taken over by President Reagan as a way of enforcing this same kind of central clearance on regulation that is already in place for congressional legislation and for executive orders. And that's important in part because regulations are actually not in the presidential toolbox directly, right? When Congress passes a law, it says that the agency will create regulations to enforce that law, not the president, him, someday herself. And that is, you know, something presidents have tried to get around through this clearance process through OIRA. The fact that they don't have direct yay or nay control over regulations, but this central clearance process at least gives them information, gives them a way of delaying regulations they don't like, trying to amend them. And if nothing else, giving them a heads up that, you know, that they might need to fire a cabinet secretary who's not doing what they want them to do. So that is a more recent addition and in some ways the most controversial, actually, because, again, regulations exist, you know, in this administrative netherworld that, you know, it may not be as directly under presidential control, but, you know, OIRA has survived now, you know, itself for 40 years and seems unlikely to go anywhere. By the way, there, I don't believe there is any nominee for a Biden OIRA director either at the moment, which is a little bit surprising.
And so in this regard, can both of you talk a little bit more about what OIRA does and how it functions within the OMB sort of ambit?
I wish we had Rachel Potter here to share.
Sure. You're just going to have to channel her.
I guess I would just say, and this is where I thought that Rachel's and Rachel Potter's analysis in the chapter of putting together a CV of OIRA's successes, right, where, what it's achieved and where it's fallen short, as someone who worked in, who had previously worked in the agency was very instructive for combining kind of a scholarly perspective as well as a practitioner perspective. And interestingly, when we were having discussions, not so much in the symposium, but we did an APSA panel before with the revised chapters. And that was actually in DC. And there were some members, retirees who attended, were somewhat critical of this. I think we're not aware that, didn't realize that, in fact, that it was less actually, it was in discussions, we're not always aware that some of the contributors had actually worked in the agency or had done pretty close interview-based analysis for their conclusion. So I guess beyond that, I don't have a lot to add beyond what Andy just said about the creation of OIRA, the fact that it's now entering the fifth decade, right? And then goes through this, for me, this was instructive for going past the budgetary process of OIRA, of OMB, to examine how OIRA actually oversees, kind of provides, I guess this is a little bit of the centralization and the clearance that Andy was talking about with executive orders, to see the same thing with agency regulations, that there is this effort to ensure that the executive branch, that the decentralization that we see in executive agencies still has a kind of a common process for vetting, approving, or changing regulations that, you know, outside of the, beyond the, in the implementation process.
Yeah, this is driven by a number of executive orders, actually, that set up this process, starting in, well, we can talk about the 1970s, but most formally in 1981, you know, quite early in his term, President Reagan issues an executive order saying basically that any regulation that has more costs than benefits cannot be issued. And that, of course, means we have to be able to figure out costs and benefits of different proposals. And we need to be able to, have some kind of regulatory impact analysis, was the original jargon, for, you know, what happens when we want to change, you know, workplace condition rules, or, you know, things dealing with OSHA or environmental policy, which was the big driver of this originally, was making sure that the EPA was not driving businesses, you know, into bankruptcy. That was the worry of the Republican administration, certainly. Even Jimmy Carter, though, in terms of, you know, why did we need this check? Well, we needed it because the EPA was full of crazy leftist, you know, green eco warriors who were going to, you know, ruin the American economy. But cost-benefit analysis, rightly considered, right, does not have to be wielded by an agenda. And so it's often attacked, you know, by the left for being too pro-business, sometimes attacked from the right for, you know, coming up with ways to justify, you know, far-reaching health and human services or workplace safety regulations. And this is a big argument, right, over how do we count costs? What counts as a benefit? What is the statistical cost of a human life? What is the social cost of carbon, right? These are things that are, you know, discussed with great acrimony over time. And obviously the way that a particular administration views them will matter for how OIRA does its work. But in some ways it's set up like other parts of OMB. It has desk officers, which deal with a certain substance of the government. There's not a huge number of them. This is a pretty small bureau, 50-ish people, which is well smaller than it was under President Reagan when it was established. And their job, you know, they have to work with other parts of OMB to get information, because they can then talk about regulation in conjunction with other management initiatives or with legislative proposals or with budgetary proposals, right? If you have, you know, if you impose a certain regulation, then probably that will have budgetary impact. And so it is an agency-wide process. They do try to cooperate, and they need to, or else they will not be able to really be effective. But I think, you know, it does become the most contentious part of OMB in some ways, at least external to the government, because they are, you know, basically trying to come to some conclusion as to whether a certain regulatory proposal, you know, is a project that's worth doing. And that is inevitably ideological, especially in today's polarized political climate.
And I just wanted to ask one final question in terms of the book itself and the work that your many contributors who are both inside and outside of government, academics and practitioners, which is a really interesting part of the book to have. And I really recommend it to interested individuals in terms of reading, because it does bring these multiple perspectives in terms of a really nicely put together book. And this is always, you know, like you don't have a favorite child. So I'm not asking you your favorite chapter. But as the chapters are coming in and after the conference, what was the most surprising aspect of the research that you, both of you scholars of the presidency and American institutions, found in terms of what your contributors were working on and what they had surfaced in terms of our understanding of this agency and how it operates?
Well, I'm glad you didn't ask us to pick a favorite, because I really couldn't. I mean, really, I just, this was truly a labor of love, and it wasn't one that I had, you know, would have taken on had it not been, had Andy not suggested this project. And I'm so glad we did. The symposium was instructive. I'm glad we have the volume as a record of, particularly as we're in the centennial year of OMB, I think to have this available to trace the evolution of the agency and to see both the internal and external assessments of its capabilities and resource demands in the modern era, is since the creation of from BOB to OMB, is very important. I guess I would say, Lily, that what I think is most interesting, or what was most surprising to me, was how, and I don't want to repeat, but it really just was reinforced, just how much how strong the institutional memory is in OMB, and how that is conveyed to scholars, how that from in interviews, in numerous in the symposium, and how that institutional memory informs political decision making by either Senate confirmed or immediately below Senate confirmed appointees.
Yeah, I would. So this is a great question. And of course, as I'm thinking about it, I go, well, that chapter's great. That was really interesting. I would say what readers, I hope, will find useful about the book is that there is a taxonomy of sorts. Here's what OMB looks like. Here are the different agencies, or sub-agencies, I should say, bureaus, parts of the office that are, you know, functional in these different ways. And here's how they work with the White House and so forth. But, you know, a lot of those scholars did take these sort of interesting perpendicular views to that. So again, I mentioned Eloise Pashikov's volume. She's writing as a law professor who's really interested in the ways in which presidents use budget authority as management, effectively. And we saw this, you know, in the Trump years with, you know, with Ukraine, but with the government shutdown, but also with the ways in which the border wall, you know, got funded despite the fact that Congress didn't want to fund a border wall, right? You get a sense of the discretion broadly granted by Congress over time. Another example would be the chapter by Dave Lewis and his co-authors, Mark Richardson and Eric Rosenthal, who are writing about management, but they're writing about it from the perspective of survey data that they have from across the executive branch, basically asking other people in government, how do you see other agencies? It's a fascinating data set. This is only a teeny part of it, but, you know, they asked, you know, is OMB influential? You know, is OMB good at what it does? Has that changed over time? And they have the data to be able to do that and to be able to think about, well, what kind of agencies, you know, are susceptible to centralized control and which really are beyond the reach of the president in most cases, and, you know, where you might want to be more attentive, for example, to finding a loyal appointee if you're a president who wants to control a given agency. And then I think I would also just give a quick shout out to Matt Dickinson's chapter, which is based largely on interviews that he and I have conducted over now 10-ish years, you know, with people who are, you know, have worked in OMB going back to the 1950s. And, you know, these are, you know, their perspective on how the agency has changed. And it comes back to this question of whether the agency has become politicized over time. You know, this notion of neutral competence, and how does that survive in an era where presidents really don't care about neutrality and arguably not so much about competence. They want responsiveness. They want political and immediate compliance, effectively, with their directives, except they find themselves in a system where that's unlikely and arguably even undesirable. So that kind of tension shows through. But then, you know, again, we've got, you know, people who were the general counsel's office at OMB, people who worked as PADs. And as Mina said, all of this was read through by a lot of OMB alums who served both as discussants at the original conference. And then we had a big meeting at OMB itself. Very exciting. In the red building, for those who want to look at the cover of the book, that's the red building, the new executive office building up on 17th Street. And yes, that was, you know, sort of the a reality check, if you will. So I'd like to be able to tell, you know, future readers that they'll be getting a good view of what happens in the agency and some good advice about, you know, what they should do should they come to run the agency later on, or to have a say in that.
And Andy, even though they can't see the cover, I think it's important to note that OMB is right side up and the White House is upside down, right? That OMB keeps the White House, right? Keeps it looking, keeps it stable and provide some continuity and clarity in what can be a sometimes upside down political world.
Yeah. Should I just note that Mina did not like this cover originally, but I think she's come around. She's
while.
It is noted in the acknowledgments. Well, I would like to thank Mina Bose and Andy Rudalevich for joining me today to talk about executive policymaking, the role of the OMB in the presidency. This is published in 2020 by Brookings Press, and I assume it's available at Brookings Press.
It is, but also wherever fine books are sold.
All of the usual sites.
All the usual sites, and of course, your local independent bookseller.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mina and Andy, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Sure.
Yeah, really enjoyed it.